Come into the temple, where you will learn the secrets of the dividend discount models and the discounted cash flow models. Everyone now into the full lotus position to begin our quest. We have the incense burning and the chimes. Are you ready? Excellent. The dividend discount models. Shares of stock are valued on the basis of the present value of the future dividend streams the stock is projected to produce. Yeah, well, they're also called DDMs, dividend valuation models, DVMs. And the name that I like the best, but is not used too often, the discounted cash flow models. If you recall, the value of a stock is based on the present value of its future cash flows. Therefore, dividend discount models should be extremely popular, right? Well, not always. During the 1990s, investors who adhered to these types of models were considered old-fashioned and outdated fuddy-duddies. But those investors weathered the 2000 to 2002 downturn very well. Dividends have become important again. And as we learned in Chapter 5, dividends don't lie. Slide number 18. The dividend discount model in its purest incarnation. The value of a stock is equal to the present value of all expected future dividend payments. That's a scary looking formula, isn't it? Well, let's explain it. The present value, the price at the value at time zero, that's what this little piece of zero means. I like to use V for value because the price could be something totally different, but I guess they mean P for present value. That's what the book uses, so I used what the book used. Is equal to the dividend in the first year divided by 1 plus K. What's K? Well, in baseball, it's a strikeout. But in this instance, it means our required rate of return. In other words, what we want to get from the stock. The book uses their first example with a required rate of return of 15%. I think it's way too high. I certainly am not shooting for 15%, but that's what the book used, so I'll use it. And then you then add to that the dividend in year number 2 divided by 1 plus the required rate of return squared. And then the dividend in year number 3 divided by 1 plus the required rate of return cubed to the third power, and so on and so forth up until the last year, T. So it's not really that scary. Hopefully it's not that scary. That's what we're doing. And don't worry, we don't have to do this. Okay, we don't need exponentiation. I promised you at the beginning of the semester, right? All you need is a calculator that can do add, subtract, multiply, and divide. You don't even need square root. So the example that the book, all four editions that we've been talking about, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, use are three annual dividends of $100 per share. Wow, $100 per share, yeah, that's what they use. So the required rate of return being 15%, we take $100 divided by 1 plus 15%, 1.15. That should look familiar from the previous lecture. And then we add to that $100 divided by 1 plus 1.15 squared, and then $100 divided by 1.15 to the third power. And if you work that out, it comes out to about $228.32. But wait a minute. How many companies pay three annual dividends and then go out of business? It's not a very good example. Plus, we keep using this term present value. Present, what does it mean? What does present value mean anyway? Piano, you used it in the previous presentation, and you never defined it, and now you're using it now, and you haven't relax, we're going to do that right now. There was a bit of method to my madness, just a bit. Slide number 19, what is present value? Present value is the value today of a lump sum or a series of payments to be received at some future date. It is the opposite of future value. Another word for that is inverse. It is the inverse of future value. Do you remember the optional future value calculations back in Chapter 1? You didn't have to do them. They were optional, and I didn't ask you to do them on the exam. But if you remember, we did the future value for a lump sum, a single payment, or we did the future value for a stream of investments or a series of deposits. So here's a lump sum calculation. If I have $10,000 today, and I'm able to receive 8% over the next 10 years, the calculation is 1 plus the rate of return, 8%, to the 10th power, 10 years, and that number is 2.1589 for a dollar, and that's how the tables work. They give you the numbers for a dollar. You multiply that times 10,000, and you wind up with $21,589. So the future value of $10,000 today, deposited in an account getting 8% for the next 10 years, is $21,589. So that's projecting into the future. Present value is the opposite. We're going to say, look, folks, in 10 years, we're going to receive $21,589. How much is it worth to us today? How much is that $21,589 worth to us in 10 years if we can get 8%? That's our required rate of return. Well, the present value discounts that $21,589, and that's the term we use. We use the term discount, not discounting at the, you know, at the supermarket or at the department store. No, not that kind of discounting. Discounting means taking a future value and bringing it back to the present. So the formula is the same, except it's the inverse, 1 divided by that. And again, we don't have to do the calculations, they're already done for us in the tables. But that present value multiplier turns out to be 0.4632, that's for a dollar, but of course, we're getting, in 10 years, $21,589, and that tells us that $21,589, 10 years from now, is worth to us today $10,000. We discounted it from the future back to the present. The present value of $21,589 in 10 years at 8% is $10,000. Present value and future value are just two sides of the same coin. In finance, present value tells us what the future value is worth now, is worth today. What would you rather have? $10,000 today or $21,589 in 10 years, assuming you're happy with 8%. The calculation is telling us they're exactly the same. So does that make sense? We're going to use it. Did the formula for the dividend discount model scare you? Slide number 20. This formula has that present value calculation built into it. And as I said, we don't have to do that. We don't have to do any exponentiation. We mortals simply use the present value tables. Just as we use the future value tables optionally, you didn't have to do it, but some of you did in Chapter 1, the formula then becomes the value, the present value, they use P sub 0, I like to use V for value, is equal to the first dividend times the present value multiplier. You don't have to divide by 1 plus K, because that's built in to the table. Plus, and we add to that, the dividend for year number 2 times the present value multiplier for year number 2. That's what this thing right here is. It's already done for you. And then the present value for year, I'm sorry, the dividend for year number three, excuse me, times the present value multiplier for the year number three, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you see that scary formula? Forget about it. You're not going to use it. Slide number 21. Let's do the same example all over again, but this time we're going to use the present value multipliers from the present value table on the class website. So you're probably going to want to print this thing out, folks, because you're going to be doing several calculations using the table. So it's a good idea to print it out. Maybe print it out if you have some colored paper so that you have it handy. So three annual dividends of $100 per share, required rate of return 15%, and as I said, I wouldn't use an example of 15%. None of the, after this, no examples are going to have 15%, okay? the first $100 dividend is equal to, is multiplied times the present value multiplier for 15% year number one. Go across to 15% down to year one. That's when you print it out. So you might have to print it out and come back to the presentation. It's up to you. And you'll find that that's 0.870 for 15% for 1 year. So that's $87. And then we're going to add to that the second dividend for year number two of $100. But this time we discount it by the present value multiplier of 15% at 2 years. 2 years at 15%. 7.756. So it's $100 times 75.60. I'm sorry, it's $100 .0.756, which is $75.60. And then the dividend for year number three is multiplied times the present value multiplier for 15% for 3 years, and that's .658. So $100 times 0.658 is $65.80. And if you add those three together, you get $228.40, which is 8 cents off. And why are we 8 cents off? Because the table only goes out to three digits. Your calculator, if you use the scientific calculator to do those calculations using the formula and the exponentiation, has more precision, so it's 8 cents. What is the present value of the future stream of dividends? Is the lingo starting to sound like something that means something? Is the speak of the language? You're starting to comprende? You're starting to understand it? At 15%, $100 in 1 year is worth $87. What would you rather have, $100 now or $87 in 1 year? Well, if your required rate of return is 15%, they're the same. In 2 years, that $100 is worth $75.60. In 3 years, it's worth $65.80 at 15%. The sum of the present values of the future dividend cash flows equals our perceived value of the stock. Now, you understand how important that required rate of return is? Because if somebody requires a much smaller rate of return, the numbers are going to be bigger because it's not going to be discounted as much. If somebody wants greater than 15%, which all I can say is good luck to them, then the numbers are going to be smaller. And notice that I only put 15% on there because they had it in this calculation. I normally would end it at around 13 or 14. So slide number 22. What we're going to do now, folks, is go through a few of the dividend discount models. And I'm just by doing the calculations, you'll know which ones are the most important, and you'll know which one, I'll tell you which ones. Forget about this one. Forget about this one. And we don't even cover all of them that are in Chapter 6 of the 6th edition, because they keep adding more. Every new edition, they add more, but these are the most important. And by the way, the first one on slide 22 isn't even in the book, the zero growth model. This assumes dividends will continue at a fixed rate indefinitely into the future. So you take the annual dividends and divide them by the required rate of return. Well, that doesn't sound like a very sophisticated calculation. It's not. It's very simple. So let's see. Annual dividend of $3 a share. Here's our example. Required rate of return 6%. If we take $3 of dividends divided by 6%, that's $50 per share. We would assume, or we would value this stock at $50. Now, if somebody had a higher, go ahead, try it. A higher required rate of return, the number would be different. If somebody had a lower required rate of return, the number would be different. Does the zero growth model look familiar to you, folks? It should. It is simply another way to view the dividend yield. Slide number 23. Do you remember the dividend yield from chapter 5? If our formula here for the value of the stock is equal to the annual dividends divided by the required rate of return, all we're doing is swapping the required rate of return and the value of the stock for the dividend yield and the market price of the stock. We just swapped those. So if you remember the dividend yield, it's the annual dividends divided by the market price. And those of you who are familiar with this, you understand you just move these two back and forth. That's okay. It just gives you the inverse. So the value of the stock sneaks down here and becomes the market price. And the required rate of return sneaks up here and becomes the dividend yield. So what are we saying? And if you don't understand it, don't worry. But what we're saying is investors who emphasize the zero growth model are valuing the stock almost exclusively for its dividend yield. Why? Because the company's not growing. That's why it's called zero growth model. Does it make sense? Again, I apologize if those of you who are a little bit confused about what I was trying to say about how it's very similar to dividend yield. It's the inverse of the dividend yield. And all you have to do is be able to calculate it. And so let's take a look at an example on 24. A real life example. This is Consolidated Edison, which some of you might know to be the utility company for New York City, Consolidated Edison. It's a utility. Right. Do utilities grow fast? No. They're keeping the lights on, keeping the fires burning and ovens and water hot. And they're not growing very fast, unless the area that they're in is growing really quickly. So they pay a solid dividend and continue to pay that dividend. And that's who our poster child, if you will. That's our typical example for the zero growth model. So if you see in any worksheets or any assignments or maybe on an exam, a utility, which model are you going to use? Right, zero growth model. So let's say the current market price on the 10th of February 2012 was $59.13. They're currently paying $2.42 per year in annual dividends and have been doing so for quite some time. So the question is, what is our required rate of return? And again, that's dependent upon the investor. So let's say we require 8%. We want 8%. Not from a utility, folks. We take the annual dividends of $2.42, divide that by the 8%, 0.08, go ahead, do it on your calculator, and you should see that it's $30.25. Well, wait a minute, it's selling for $59. The stock, according to us, is overpriced if our required rate of return is 8%. You see? So we'd say, not a very good buy. Well, why don't we try 5%? At $2.42 divided by 0.05, the stock should be it's worth, $48.40. It's still too expensive if our required rate of return is 5%. So with that market price of $59.13, the stock is yielding 4.1%. The zero growth model works well for stable income producing stocks for which we are valuing the stock according to the stream of reliable dividends. Now, let's go one step further. Slide number 25. Now, I don't like this name, but it's kind of a silly name, but that's what they call it. The constant perpetual growth model. It reminds me of the Department of Redundancy Department, because doesn't constant and perpetual, don't they mean the same thing? Anyway, that's the name, the constant perpetual growth model. And this assumes dividends will continue to grow at a specified rate perpetually, which is a great word, perpetually, in perpetuity, into the future. And it's the same model, folks. It's getting a little tricky, but not that tricky. Remember the zero growth model? Annual dividends divided by required rate of return? There it is. Except what we're doing now is we're adding a term here to account for the fact that this company is growing their dividends constantly into the, or at least they have in the past, and we assume they're going to do it in the future. We don't know that for sure. And then we divide in the dividend, in the denominator, we then reduce the required rate of return by the constant growth rate. So we add these two parts to the formula, to the zero growth model, and we get a model now that takes into account the fact that a company is growing their dividends into the future. Does that make sense? Go back and look at it again. Go back and look at the zero growth model and see how the constant perpetual growth model is just one step further. So this is the example on page 184, the sixth edition. It's in the others. A company that's currently selling for $10 per share and the annual growth rate of the dividend has been 5%, and we expect it to be 5% into the future. We don't know, but that's what we expect. So that means this is not the price of the stock. I apologize. Did I say the price of the stock? The dividend of the stock is $10 per share, right? We're trying to come up with what we believe is a good price. I said the price of the stock. The dividend of the stock is $10 per share. And we have seen them growing their dividend at 5% per share per year. So we assume that next year's dividend, not next year's price, will be $10.50. Now there's that, I just want to punch these guys. The required rate of return, 15%. It's too high, but anyway, that's what they chose to use. So you take the $10 annual dividends divided by 1 plus the constant growth rate. Does that look familiar from the previous presentation? 1.05? And then we divide that by the required rate of return minus the constant growth rate of 5%. So $10 times 1.05 is $10.50. 15% minus 5% is 10%. So do that. Make sure you do it on your calculator. $10.50 divided by 10%, or 0.1, is equal to $105. We believe the stock should be worth $105 per share, because we're requiring a 15% return. Run it again with a 10% rate of return. You see, the number will change. This model is good for companies with consistent dividend growth. So, let's look at some. Let's look at some real-life examples of companies that have had constant perpetual growth of their dividends. Dividend growth rates that have been consistent over several years. And here's our first example on slide 26. Johnson & Johnson. You ever hear of Johnson & Johnson? Band-Aids, Tylenol, Q-tips, baby shampoo. They make a lot more than that. Most all in the healthcare profession. Lots of different things. They're a member of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, a blue chip stock, been paying dividends for over 100 years. Current market price as of the 10th of February 2012, $64.60. They're currently paying $2.28 in annual dividends. Let's assume that the dividends are growing around 8%. So now I want you to do these, folks, because you're going to be doing several of these, so you might as well get used to them now. Our required rate of return is, say, 13%. 13%. We want 13%. So you take the annual dividends times 1 plus the growth rate of the dividends, 1.08, divided by our required rate of return, 13%, minus 8%, and you get 2.4624 divided by 0.05, 5%, right, 13 minus 8, and that's $49.25. It's selling for $64.60. Not a great buy if we require 13%, huh? Well, what if we change our required rate of return to 10%? What if we were to say, okay, well, let's say we'll get 10%. $2 and 28 cents times 1.08, that doesn't change, divided by 10% minus 8% is equal to the same $2.46.24 divided by 2% now, 10% minus 8%, 0.02, $123.12. What a deal. Yeah. Note, the model is very sensitive to our choice of our required rate of return. Do you see that? Yeah. Do you think Johnson & Johnson is a good deal? You think people are going to stop using baby powder? Right. And that's not all they make, folks. They make a lot of pharmaceuticals, and they make stents, which are devices that go inside your arteries and veins in your heart to keep you alive, and all kinds of stuff, medical devices and the like. Yeah, do you think Johnson & Johnson is a good value? Slide 27. Another example, Procter & Gamble. Who are these people? Procter & Gamble. Have you ever heard of Tide and Pampers and Gillette and Crest? They just sold their Pringles. Yeah, they make consumer staples, they're called, and they've been around forever. They're a member of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Their current market price is $63.88 as of the 10th of February, and they're currently paying $2.10 in annual dividends. And again, let's assume that the dividends are growing around 8% per year. Our required rate of return is 13% again. So let's use 13%. The $2.10 of annual dividends times 1.08 divided by 13% minus 8%, 2.268 divided by 5%, 0.05, and that's $45.36. Well, Procter & Gamble doesn't quite measure up to our 13% required rate of return, does it? Well, what if we just lowered it to 10%? What if our required rate of return were only 10%? You get $2.10 times 1.08, that same doesn't change, divided by 10% minus 8%, so $2.268 divided by 0.02 is $113.40. The model says that Procter & Gamble is undervalued if we require only a 10% rate of return. Are people all of a sudden going to stop using soap and toothpaste and diapers and toilet paper, Charmin shampoo and shaving? I don't think so. Slide number 28. Another blue chip stock, Coca-Cola. Yeah. The current market price is $67.94, that's as of the 10th of February 2012, currently paying $1.88 in annual dividends. And again, let's assume dividends are growing around 8% per year. Our required rate of return is 13%. We run through the calculations, hopefully you've done them enough times that you can do them now on your own, and we get $40.61 at 13%. So much for caramel-covered fizzy sugar water. But what if we lower our rate of return to only 10%? Then we wind up with $101.52. Maybe we ought to spend some more time researching KO. In the United States, folks, I have a hard time believing this, but the average person drinks 360 Cokes a year. That's one a day. I don't drink any. I can't stand this stuff. So that means somebody's drinking at least two a day. In China, the average is only six per year, and in India, it's two. Now, I just read something just recently that said they're up to seven a year in India, so that must be up to more in China, so maybe my numbers are wrong. So I have to go back and I have to go find it definitively. I don't know if I actually trusted that one source, but it might be saying in the urban areas, because there's a lot of people in India who have never even seen Coca-Cola. What do you think it is in Mexico? Mexico, they love Coca. It's more than the United States. Mexicans per capita drink more Coca-Cola than United Staters. What is it? Estadounidenses. They call us United Staters. I like that name. And, yeah. As we said, I don't know if we said it in this class, but Coca-Cola is a charmed company, folks. They really are. They think about it. It's unbelievable. It's the second most popular word in the world. Coca-Cola. Okay, what's the first? Okay. Both of them are English words, yeah. Well, at least Coca-Cola came from Atlanta, and okay came from in the South somewhere also. So, think about it. In Mandarin Chinese, Coca-Cola sounds like happy drink. A charmed existence. Compare that to General Motors, that many years ago exported the Chevy Nova to Latin America without bothering to ask what Nova means in Spanish. It literally means it does not go. Nova, no go. It does not go. You don't say the it in Spanish. It's understood, and you don't have does. You don't have the helping verb. No go. It doesn't go. Are you going to buy a car that translates to no? It doesn't go in your language? Next. Slide number 29. General Electric. Current market price, $18.88. Currently paying 68 cents in annual dividends. Let's assume the dividends are also growing around 8% per year. What if our required rate of return is 13%? Well, then the calculation comes out to about $14.69. It doesn't look so good. If we lower it down to 10%, then $36.72. If we are happy with 10%, GE appears to be a great deal. But we must add the caveat. GE was hammered by the Great Recession. Why? Because at the time they were making more money off of their finance than they were off of their selling light bulbs and jet engines and power plants and medical devices, all the other things that GE makes. They become more and more a finance company. They just sold NBC just about a year or so ago. So this is after GE dropped its dividend down to 40 cents from $1.24 at the peak in 2009. After decades of growing the dividend, in 2010, they started raising the dividend again very aggressively. First to 48 cents and the 56 cents and the 60 cents, and now they're up to 68 cents per year. So you see what's going on? They're saying, we're back, folks, we're back. So, pretty interesting. Slide number 30. Our last example. Altria. Altria? It's the name for Philip Morris, folks, the domestic cigarette producers. He used to be in the Dow, but they took it out because they were shamed having a tobacco company in the Dow. Current market price as of December, I'm sorry, I keep saying December, the 10th of February 2012, $29.22. They're currently paying $1.64 in annual dividends. Assuming dividends are also growing around 8%, same required rate of return of 13%. $1.64 times 1.08 divided by 13% minus 8% works out to be $35.42. What a buy! Better than a 13% rate of return if you ignore the potential tobacco-related lawsuit damage and the fact that tobacco kills 400,000 Americans each year. Using this model, investors are currently requiring approximately a 14.06 required rate of return. Plug in the numbers and you get close to $29.23. Would you buy Altria? Would you buy a company that sells a product that when used as directed, kills its consumers? Well, if you were an investor who bought, you've done darn well off of Altria over the decades. They've split themselves up. They used to own Kraft. They spun that off, and then they spun off their international, their outside the United States tobacco business into a company called Philip Morris International. They own a bunch of stock in both the companies, folks. They're not stupid. Yeah. And so, folks, you have to ask yourself, would you actually buy a company that sold something like tobacco. Some people won't. In fact, there are some mutual funds that just do not invest in tobacco or alcohol, or we talked about socially responsible and the like. But it sure is a good sign that these companies have been growing their dividends over time, isn't it? And that after the decade where we had virtually, well, we had negative returns for a couple of years, no return from stocks, it looks as though many stocks, or these blue chip stocks, are undervalued, doesn't it? Okay, let's continue. Who is that? Who is that? Yeah? Yeah, what do you want? Who are you?
You know who it is.
It's my conscience.
Come clean.
Come clean about what?
Fess up.
Fess up about what? I made them up. I made them up. All these companies are growing their dividends faster than 8%.
That's better.
Oh, my conscience. Do you understand, folks? Do you understand what's going on? The constant perpetual growth model is very sensitive to the assumed growth rate of dividends. Not only our required rate of return, but how fast the companies are growing their dividends. On slide 31, we see that the recent dividend growth rates of Coke, Altria, Procter & Gamble, and Johnson & Johnson are all currently higher than 8%. Coke is 9.9%, Altria 12.5%, Procter & Gamble is 13.2%, and Johnson & Johnson is 14.2%. And GE is much higher, but that's because it went way down. But the model does not work if the required rate of return is equal to or less than the dividend growth rate. You get bizarre results. You get division by zero or negative prices, which don't make any sense whatsoever. So therefore, we should actually raise our expected rates of return for all of these companies. All of these companies are actually much better buys than what the model is telling us for our 13 and 10% rates of return. Now, does that mean that in tomorrow they're all going to... No, but personally, I am very optimistic that the next 5-10 years are going to be the reverse of what we saw the last 10 years. But there are no guarantees, but I'm telling you me, my wife and I, because we're a team in that respect, we are heavily invested in companies that are global in nature, large cap companies, and I believe, and again, you don't know if it's going to happen, but that these are going to do well over time. But note, please note, as it says in the bottom of slide 31, these are blue chip companies with long histories of rising dividends and rarefied air, so to speak. Let's continue. Slide number 32. If 1 is good and 2 is better, then 12 must be best, right? That's the American way. So here's the constant growth model. This assumes dividends will continue to grow at a specified rate for a specified number of years. What did they do? They took the constant perpetual growth model and they added a term to account for the growth for a certain number of years. Yeah, so basically, folks, they're getting tricky, right? They're saying, well, what if the company only grows that fast for 5 years? Do you have to know this, as it says on the right-hand side? No. But what I'm trying to show you, folks, and it's in the book, is that the constant growth model simply adds on, takes the constant perpetual growth model one step further, adding the term to account for a constant growth for a number of years. Just as the constant perpetual growth model evolved from the zero growth model, adding an additional term to account for the constant growth of dividends. But it's just, is it realistic to believe that, oh yes, we know that this company is going to grow their dividends at this specific rate for a specific number of years? You're lucky if you can guess the next 2 or 3 years clarity, with any kind of precision, which you can't. It's very difficult. Slide 33, it gets even worse. The two-stage dividend growth model, also called the variable growth model, assumes that dividends will continue to grow at a specified rate into the future, presumably the fast growth stage, and then grow at a second, presumably slower growth rate once the company matures. You see, it's the one we just looked at, the constant growth model, which is the constant perpetual model, with this little added on, and then we add on this mug, which is trying to say this is the second growth spurt, and notice I've crossed it out and put all kinds of skulls and crossbones and all kinds of bombs and stuff like that. Many decades ago, folks, Benjamin Graham warned against using overly sophisticated mathematical models to value stocks. And I think, you know, this is an example of what he's talking about. This model may look very impressive, especially to those who love math, but it has some serious problems. It is very difficult to accurately predict future dividend growth during the initial fast growth stage of a stock. Usually, companies do not pay significant dividends while they're growing quickly. Often, they don't pay any dividends while they're growing quickly. So, don't bother with this. But I just wanted you to see it and see how, when academics get involved, you know, you just, they just keep adding more. And what if this happens? Well, it ain't gonna happen. Now, let's turn our attention to some observations of the dividend discount model. Slide 34. How do you use them for a company that isn't paying any dividends? Well, that's an easy answer. The simple and easy answer is you can't. The constant perpetual growth model is usually an unrealistic assumption, except for a very small number of companies that have the power to constantly raise their growth, grow their dividends, at least in line with inflation or maybe better. Dividend growth rates are very difficult to estimate. With large cap, well-established companies, historical growth rates may be useful. But with fast-growing companies and new industries, well, it's pretty near impossible. I should say it is impossible. I say it's almost impossible. The problems of the dividend discount models notwithstanding. Repeat after me, okay? I want to hear you. The value of a stock is based on the present value of its future cash flows. So now you see a stock not as a piece of paper, now electronic piece of information, that people are trading back and forth. You see it as a stream of income coming back at you. And we want to know, we want to put some kind of value on that stream of income. And that's what the dividend discount models do. Let's take it one step further. The dividend and earnings model, which I don't like the name. It's also called the discounted cash flow model, which is a better name, but you hear people say dividend earnings model more often. This uses the present value of expected dividends and the present value of the expected future price to value a share of stock. Remember the very first pure example where we had three annual dividends and then the company somehow mysteriously disappeared? Well, folks, the company doesn't disappear. Maybe it does, and every once in a while, Kodak, right? But normally, it's still there, and the value of the stock is something that we can cash in. We can sell the stock or we could hang on to it. So what we're going to do is we're going to use not only the dividends, but the price of the stock, or the expected future price of the stock. It does not really use any earnings, so why is it called dividend and earnings model? I don't know. That's the way the world is. Have you ever heard of French toast? It's not from France, and it really ain't toast, but they call it French toast. What are you going to do? See, here's the formula. The value of stock is equal to the present value of the future dividends plus the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell it. We will use the present value multipliers from the table. It's not covered specifically in our text, but it's really just that pure form of the DDM, the dividend discount model, that fancy-looking formula that when we started this presentation, with the present value of the expected price of the stock as our final cash inflow. And as with the other DDMs, the model is very sensitive to our estimates and our choice of required rate of return, and hence can be very far off the mark. Slide number 36. Here's an example. And there's a spreadsheet, by the way, on the website that makes life a little bit easier. It makes life actually a lot easier. Let's assume it's January 1st, 2012. Pretzels Unlimited is currently selling for $22 per share and will pay $2 per share in dividends in 2012. PU expects to increase their dividends to $2.20 in 2013, $2.30 in 2014, and $2.30 in 2015. We will be selling the stock at the end of 2015, and we expect the price to be $27 per share at that time. Our required rate of return is 12%. So if we go back to the formula, the value of the stock is equal to the present value of the future dividends, so we have to discount those future cash flows, plus the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell, the expected price. We don't know what the price is really going to be, but we can come up with an expectation. So you take the $2 for year 2012, multiply it times the present value multiplier for 1 year at 12%. So you need the table. And see, face-to-face class, I would say, here's the table, make sure you get it out and take a look. And then we add to that $2.20, the dividend we're going to get in 2013, times the present value multiplier for year number two at 12%, which is 0.797. Add to that $2.30 plus the present value multiplier for year number three, 0.712. $2.30 times the present value for year number four, present value multiplier. You see what we're doing? We're discounting these future cash flows. And then at the end of 2015, we believe the stock is going to be worth $27, so we'll use the same multiplier. Here's where people trick up. Sometimes they'll use the next year. No. Use the same year. It's 2015. It's 4 years from now. So if you do all those calculations, you wind up with a present value of the stock at $23.81. The market is currently offering us these shares at $22. So we say to ourselves, hey, we think this stock for us at 12% is worth $23.81. This is a pretty good stock to buy. You understand? It's more than what the current price is. We can buy $23.81 for what we believe is worth $23.81 for $22. That makes sense? Okay, let's reposition the problem and see if it's a little easier to do. This is slide 37 in table format. And this is what I draw on the board in the face-to-face class. I'll say, okay, folks, let's calculate it this way because it's a whole lot easier. You write down the years in one column, and this is what the spreadsheet's going to look like. And then you write down the cash flows, and then you write down the present value multipliers. Now notice, here's a tricky part. This is the same year, 2015, so we use the same present value multiplier. And then you multiply the cash flows times the present value multipliers, that is discounting those cash flows, and you wind up with the discounted cash flows, add them all up, and you wind up with the same number we got on the previous slide, but I think it is much easier to comprehend, much easier to calculate in this format, yes? If not, fine. If so, yes, use it. But let's go one step further. On slide 38, what we find is we want to add the two cash flows for the year 2015 together. And it's a more simplified table format. It saves us a couple of manual calculations, but more importantly, it allows us to use a special spreadsheet function. So you see how this one is exactly the same as the previous slide, except we've combined the two cash flows for 2015? Well, if we create a spreadsheet like that, we get to use a special spreadsheet function to calculate, slide 39, the internal rate of return. Now, folks, did you think you were going to learn about IRR, internal rate of return, in a first semester community college introduction to investments class? Well, you are. Usually, you don't learn about this until you get to upper level or graduate school. The internal rate of return is a measure of what rate of return we expect to get from a series of cash flows, including both positive, sometimes called inflows, and negative, sometimes called outflows. So we have to take into account money that goes out and money that comes in. Someday, when you take an upper level or graduate finance or investment class, you will learn how to manually compute internal rate of return. And hopefully, dear students, you will not have a sadistic professor who will require you to calculate it manually more than once. I certainly hope you do not. But maybe you will. I mean, it's so much easier to just put the numbers into a spreadsheet and press the enter button, okay? But in other words, we required a 12% rate of return from Pretzels Unlimited, and we found that we were getting better than that. What do our numbers tell us will be our expected rate of return? Slide number 40. If you call up the spreadsheet on the class website, or if you build it yourself, it's very simple. You put in the cash flows. Now, the first cash flow is an outlay. It's an outflow. So you have to put it in as negative. You understand? You have to record both negative and positive cash flows. Cash outflows, because we had to pay $22 for the stock at time zero, so that is its own year. And then the first year, we received $2 dividend. Second year, $2.20. Third year, $2.30. And then the fourth year, we received $2.30 in dividends plus the stock we believe was worth $27. We could sell it at the end of 2015 for $27. We plug in the formula internal rate of return, the cells B2 through B5, and if you're not familiar with this spreadsheet, you really do need to take Business 122 or the CIS 101 class, or just teach yourself how to use a spreadsheet, because it's a very handy tool to have, especially if you want to do investing. And then we put in our guess. Huh? Yes, it's a tricky thing to calculate internal rate of return. You could leave it zero, and the spreadsheet will try to do its best to find the number, or put in a guess, what you think the number is, and that helps the spreadsheet do a better job. And why? That's when you get to the graduate level, you'll learn why. In the face-to-face class now, we would take a look at the example spreadsheet. You're going to take a look at the example spreadsheet on your own, maybe now, maybe later. Is this cool or what, folks? This is very cool. Because now we know if we're able to buy a stock for $22 and we get these dividends and the stock is worth $27, then we're going to get approximately 14.51%. Now, those are big ifs, right? They could cut the dividend next year, the stock price could plummet, and we wouldn't be getting 14.51%. But it sure is cool, I think. Excuse me. Slide number 41. But wait! It gets cooler! Example number 2. Genes are us. You know, anything has to do with biotechnology, you know. It reminds me of that joke. Did you hear what one chromosome said to the other chromosome? Do these genes make me look fat? Genes R Us is currently selling for $21 per share. It pays no dividends, folks. It doesn't even have any earnings. It's losing money. But we believe that Genes R Us will sell for around $50 per share in 5 years. Our required rate of return is 13%. How can we determine if this is a good investment? Well, with no dividends, which model can we use? The dividends and earnings model can still be useful. Why? Because the formula is the value of the stock is equal to the present value of the future dividends plus the present value of the price of the stock when you plan to sell. Well, if you ain't getting those dividends, then the present value of nothing is nothing. Yeah, in other words, zero times anything is zero. But wait a minute, we can get a cash flow from the price of the stock in 5 years if we believe that the stock is going to be $50. So what we do is we go across the 13%, that's our required rate of return, down to 5 years, and make sure you do it, and you should see that the present value multiplier is 0.543. So you discount that $50 5 years into the future for 13% by multiplying it times the present value multiplier 0.543, and you wind up with $27.13. So this is a good stock to buy, isn't it? Well, folks, I think by now you're starting to get the idea that something that's brand new, hot, exciting new technologies, but doesn't have a dime of earnings, doesn't have a history of paying dividends, they can't pay dividends, they don't got any earnings, it's very risky. This is the kind of stock that will break your heart. This is the kind of stock that in 5 years will be worth $50 or 50 cents. And these are the kind of stocks that broke my heart. I didn't buy that many of them, folks. I just would run around to San Diego because that's where a lot of these kind of companies are and talk to the employees and the other investors and say, oh, this is cool, knowing full well that it could all fall into the porcelain oasis, and it sure did. Unlike the dividend discount models, but when we bought companies like Procter & Gamble and General Electric and Coca-Cola and the blue chip companies, did we loot? No, we, like Benjamin Graham said, I'm not saying, not giving you any specific company. Don't take them as recommendations. Go out and buy General Electric. But companies like those. And that's the bonus assignment for Chapter 6, is to do what we just did. The price models and the dividend discount models for one or two, maybe two companies that are in that same mold. So check out the bonus, and I sure hope that you do it. Okay? Now, folks, let me ask you a question. After you've done all these calculations, what I want you to do is throw them away. I'm serious. I want you to just say, fine, I've done the calculations, I've done the numbers, throw them away. You want to be very careful about creating an illusion of precision. Because if you haven't figured it out yet, these predictions are just blowing smoke, as people often say, or smoke and mirrors. Or just putting your finger up and trying to see which way, licking your finger and putting it up into the wind and trying to see which way the wind goes. All we're doing, folks, is trying to tilt the odds in our favor. Does that make sense? I hope it does. And what I want you to do, after you've done all the calculations about the company that you're interested in, and that looks great, throw them away and ask yourself, do I want to own this company? As Warren Buffett says, if I could buy the entire company, would I want to own this company as my own company? And then and only then, yes, I do. I want to be a part owner of this company. Peter Lynch uses the, and you're going to read one up on Wall Street, aren't you? Right, yeah. He uses the story. After he did all his calculations, he used three-ring binders for every company. He would then hold the thing up in the air and say, okay, I'm buying this, or I'm selling this, or I'm holding this stock because of this reason. He told it's a 90-second story. Yeah, okay, so great. And I wish you phenomenal success if you use these tools. When you use these tools. I wish you phenomenal success. So now, let us continue. Slide 42, the residual income model. This is yet another model that is a cousin of the dividend discount models. It's called the residual income model. As with the dividend and earnings model, It allows us to value a company that is not paying dividend. It basically uses earnings instead of dividends. It's very similar to the constant perpetual growth model. We will skip it for now and maybe come back to it later. I think you have enough on your plate as it is. Yeah, I think so. And then, of course, as the editions went from the 4th to the 5th to the 6th, they kept adding more and more models. So we've done enough. We'll ditto for the other models. You want to go in there and bang away at them? Please don't let me stop you. But as Benjamin Graham warns us, exactly, don't get too overly sophisticated. Slide 43. Okay, Piano, this is all great. But just where are we supposed to get all this historical information anyway, huh? And just who decides what next year's earnings per share, sales per share, cash flow per share, dividends per share, etc., etc., etc. are going to be? Let alone the expected price of a stock in 3 to 5 years. Well, before the internet, should that be BI? This information was not readily available to the general public. Normally, you would ask your broker for it. Or you would use one of the securities industry's trusted information sources. And traditionally, for many decades, the most respected source was the value line. Slide 44. Still one of the most respected and trusted sources of data and analysis. Traditionally, it was often the only source many investors use for data and analysis, along with the company's materials, of course. There's a group that we've discussed, the betterinvesting.org, the National Association of Investors Corp, and this is what they use. They use the value line. I mean, some of them use the Standard & Poor's version, but they weren't as good. They aren't as good. I haven't seen them in a few years. I haven't seen them in a while. But the value line was their Bible. I shouldn't use the term Bible, but it was their trusted source. But it's not cheap, folks, and you can see why. They do extensive research on thousands of companies. If you're an individual investor, it's $600 per year for $598. That's for the print edition where they send them to you in the mail. The online edition is a little cheaper, but not much, $538. But that's what libraries are for. You go to the library and spend an afternoon just flipping through the value line doing your research. And sadly, they're no longer in the Southwestern College Library. Casualty of the budget crisis. Because it costs the libraries a lot more than $600 a year. I'm a big fan of the value line, especially their timeliness and safety indicators. One study, which ignored transaction costs and tax consequences, only used their timeliness indicator. It showed how you would have beaten the market handsomely over a 20-year period by just buying and selling stocks as they received and lost their number one timeliness designation. Now, obviously, that's in the past, doesn't mean it's going to work in the future, but it's a pretty good, it's a pretty good sign that people got their heads screwed on straight. Slide number 45. So in the book, in the 6th, 5th, 4th, and 3rd editions, is the value line example using McGraw-Hill, which is a very large company, folks. They're the ones who actually wrote the book, the textbook. They're the company that's responsible for the textbooks and many other textbooks. And they're the ones who charge an arm and a leg for those books. They own radio stations and television stations and magazines, and they own Standard & Poor's. Remember them? And on one sheet of paper, they stuffed so much information. Can you find the value line indicators, the future price projections, the historical data, the cash assets, the receivables, inventory, and other assets, the description analysis of the business, the historical annual rates, the institutional buying and selling, the amount of debt and number of shares outstanding, the company's financial strength, the stability, the price growth, and the earnings predictability ratings, the sales per share, the cash flow per share, the price earnings per share. Yeah, the 5-year earnings price to earnings ratio. Yeah, you see, folks, this is all falling into line. And you know that McGraw-Hill was really angry that the authors said, we need to put the value line into our book. Because they probably said, can't you use the Standard & Poor's? Because Standard & Poor's does the same kind of thing, but they're not as good. At least I haven't seen them in several years. Maybe they're better. But I always thought, boy, Standard & Poor's, can you do at least as well as the value line? They're your primary competitor. But I like the value line. So you know that McGraw-Hill was a little bit miffed that the authors wanted them to use their competitors. So let's take a look at slide 46. Look! Hopefully you open your book and turn to the... And you can go to the valueline.com and they have some sample ones that they'll show you for free. But look at this puppy. Here it is. Sales per share, cash flow per share, earnings per share, average annual P.E. ratio. Yeah, right. And this is the coolest part. Look at, there's the prices. And then this is late 2009 when the book was last published, the sixth edition. How do you know or where are you going to get the 3 to 5 year target price? Look at the value line. It says, we believe that McGraw-Hill's going to be worth between $48 and $68 or so in the years 2012, 2013, 2014. So you see how we keep using this 3 to 5 year time frame? We could use the value line's predictions. Doesn't mean they're going to be right. And then the bottom of the page talks about the business, gives them their analysis, sales, earnings per share, dividends per share, cash assets, all these other pieces of information that you may or may not use. So slide number 48, let's put Value Line to the test. In late 2009, the price of McGraw-Hill was $28.73. Their price prediction for early 2012 was in the range from around $48 to $68. On February 10th, 2012, McGraw-Hill's price closed at $45.52. It almost hit $48 a month ago on January 10th. Not bad predictions. Now remember, when they made this prediction at the end of 2009, the stock market had rallied somewhat from the depths of the 2008-2009 crisis, but many people were still predicting the imminent end of the world and the universe as we know it. By the way, some of them are still predicting the end of the world. Okay, well let's take a look at the Value Line prediction from the fourth edition. The Value Line prediction from the fourth edition was made in mid-2005, and so they had seen McGraw-Hill do pretty darn well over the last several years, and they believed that in 2008, 2009, it was going to be around $70 to about, $82 or so. Slide 51. How did they do in mid-2005? Well, their price prediction for late 2009 was in the range from $66 to around $82. McGraw-Hill's price was hovering around $24 in late 2009. What happened? Well, it reached $70 in mid-2007. So they were initially correct. But it started falling as the credit market started reacting to the home mortgage loan crisis. The organic matter hit the ventilating device, and they were standing right in the way of that organic matter. Because McGraw-Hill owns Standard & Poor's. Yep, you've heard of them. And they were the ones who were saying, no problem, all these mortgages, AAA rating, folks. People can just lie about how much money they're making and get out a $500,000 loan, pay $1,600 for the first year, $1,900 the next year, $2,600 the third year, and $3,400 per month the fourth year, lose their home to foreclosure after 2 or 3 years took for them to kick them out, and we're still living through this, folks. The price then plummeted as the home mortgage loan crisis spread to the entire financial sector in 2008 and 9 and spread to the entire economy. We went into a severe recession, so-called the Great Recession. Their mid-2007 prediction, if you have the fifth edition of the book, was even uglier. But what about their early 2003 prediction from the third edition? Let's take a look at that. In early 2003, they believed, wait a minute, the stock price was $54, and they believed it would be between 90 and 110? Well, what's going on here is that the stock split. So in mid-2003, Value Line predicted that the price of the McGraw-Hill would be around 90 to 110 in 2005 or 6. Why so much higher? They split their stock 2-for-1, so you have to divide these prices by 2 to compare them to the previous two predictions. Hooray for the Value Line! They were bang on the money. McGraw-Hill reached the 120 level by the end of 2006. That's $60 split adjusted. So they have a pretty darn good track record, folks. I get a kick when some investors trash the Value Line. They're usually short-term investors because Value Line, I mean, they do talk about the short-term, but they always couch their things in saying, if you're a long-term investor, they make mistakes too, just like everybody else. But I would sure love to see how those investors' long-term results stack up against the long-term results of the Value Line, huh? Who do you think would have the better results? Well, I kind of know that in general, these people are... Well, again, are you an investor long-term, or are you a speculator, trader short-term? So, folks, what do you think? You are now armed with some very powerful tools. Go back over them, do the worksheets, do the assignments. Hopefully you'll be motivated to spend an afternoon in the library and do the bonus assignments, and I wish you great success. That's it for Chapter 6. When we come back in Chapter 17, we'll learn how to perform even more ratio analysis and take a look at financial statements. See ya!